I'm Don Merrill, and I'm talking with Farah Chaichi. Ms. Chaichi is a challenger for Oregon House seat in District 35. Ms. Chaichi, welcome.
Thank you.
Ms. Chaichi, my first question for you, ma'am, is why are you running for Oregon's 35th House District seat?
Well, I am running on a human rights platform. I want to help get transformative legislation passed to protect vital human rights for every Oregonian. And if being in the state legislature is how I can help make that happen, then that's where I want to be. I've been an activist for a while. I've been involved in local politics since 2014. And a lot of people might think that this is a natural progression for me, but honestly, I hadn't seen that coming. But I want voices like mine and experiences like mine reflected in Salem. And last year, at the end of the year, my friend, Representative Winsbee Campos, approached me and asked me to consider running for the House seat because she thought I would do a good job representing our community and we share the same values. I had to think about it for a while, though, because I'm sure you can imagine this is a lot of work, but also, unfortunately, last year, we lost my mom to COVID, and every plan that I had, because I had maybe been thinking about city council, sort of went on the back burner, you know? But when I was approached about this, you know, I sat down and made a pro-con list, and the very first pro on my pro list was I would get to have an opportunity to make serious change in our state that could help lots of people, and I could be a representative from the people, and that's why I'm running.
I wanted to ask you about that. You said you didn't realize or expect to be where you are, and I have a question just for that. So you majored in criminal justice, you minored in political science, you have a master's degree in paralegal studies, and you worked for a couple of law firms, but much of your focus does not seem to be so much on law and law enforcement, but on social services and pursuit of things like healthcare and housing and education. So I wanted to ask you, were those human rights issues always your priority?
Sort of. So in about the eighth grade, I watched a documentary about the KKK, and growing up in Oregon, because I'm a lifelong Beaverton resident, you know that they don't always teach you the history of your state. And so I had no reference of what the KKK had been doing. They hadn't taught us about it in school. So when I got to high school the next year, my friend and I looked for an anti-racism club. And shockingly, in the state of Oregon, we didn't have one. I mean, at this school. But we did have an Amnesty International club. And that's sort of where I got introduced to human rights. And the main issue that Amnesty had piloted, like their first main focus was criminal justice, specifically abolition of the death penalty. And that's where I sort of got involved. I got into school and studied criminal justice and political science because I thought I want to be a public defender and I want to abolish the death penalty. And those two areas of study seem like how I would get there. But also being in Amnesty, you learn about a whole host of other issues that are going on. And so after I graduated college, the economy tanked shortly thereafter, and I just started getting jobs where I could get hired instead of where my passion was. And around 2014, I realized just doing a job to survive was not good enough for my soul, I guess. And so I got involved with the Beaverton Human Rights Advisory Commission and really started paying attention to the hyper-local injustices that people are going through in my own backyard.
We're going to talk about one of those injustices later on. But you're running right now against Zelos Marchant, Democrat Zelos Marchant, and Republican Daniel Martin for the district seat. Why do you think you can beat them?
I think I have a lot of lived experiences that reflect the district. We are heavily working class. We're the most diverse county in the state, and I am the exact median age of people living in Washington County. I'm also a renter, and our district has a lot of densely populated apartment complexes. So that alone, I think, makes me good for the school. But I also, like I said, got involved in local politics in 2014. So I've sort of been active with lots of campaigns and candidates, especially Mayor Lacey Beatty and Representative Campos and Ashley Hartmeyer Prigg, who've all shown they have very strong ground games. And if I want to be a representative for the people, I'm going to win this with the people. My plan is to knock a lot of doors and get a lot of support from people who haven't heard my name before.
You're also running against Democratic incumbent Dacia Graber. Why do you think you can beat her?
Actually, with redistricting, I think that Dacia is in, I forget what the number is, but they've changed the numbers all around. So she's in Tigard, but I'm in Beaverton, Alloa. And I think she's unopposed.
Okay, I'll have to check that. On your website, you describe how your mother and father raised you and your brother in Beaverton with the belief that we only needed to attend school, work hard, go to college, and we could get good jobs that would afford us a life like theirs. But then you say, unfortunately, the ever-growing inequality of our current system has made it impossible for myself and millions of other hardworking people to obtain those promised opportunities. In what way?
Well, I think a lot of people are saddled with student debt that they just are never going to pay. I mean, personally, I feel like I'm probably going to die before the government gets its money back. And couple that with, in Beaverton, we've seen huge cost of living and housing rates. And it's hard for you not only to get a good job when the economy tanks right after you graduate from college, but then you are constantly playing catch up at that point. And the minimum wage, even if you get a just minimum wage job, is not anywhere near what you need for a two-bedroom apartment, let alone to own a home. I can afford the rent on my apartment just fine, and it's more than some mortgages, but because I don't have, what is it, 20% of a down payment on a house that's just obscenely unaffordable, I'm not allowed to buy that home. So that's mostly what I was referring to today.
Workers' wages have increased during the pandemic, and employers have had to be much more accommodating in terms of remote work, for example. As the pandemic eases, those employers that gave people things like more freedom, higher pay, or more flexibility, do you think that as things more return to normal, they'll return to some of the same things that caused workers to resign in the Great Resignation in the first place?
I haven't actually heard, maybe I'm in the wrong circle. I haven't heard a lot of people getting huge pay bumps from their employer. I personally finally have a savings account, but that's because of the stimulus checks. But I do think that the benefits, like of working from home, they're really going to depend on what the employer sees as the cost versus benefit. Some of these office complexes, they're extremely expensive to rent out. And if you have your workforce at home, you don't have to worry about renting out that office space. But other industries or other employers might find that having people on site where you can just turn around and talk to your coworker is better for their business. I'm not entirely sure what we'll see happen. And it's kind of strange being downtown now and seeing people haven't come back yet. So it's hard to say. The mask mandate just lifted. I guess we'll see what happens.
Until July 2022, a tenant can avoid termination and eviction for non-payment of monthly rent if they've applied for emergency rental assistance and if they provide documentation of their application for safe harbor protection to their landlord. Do you feel people have the help they need to negotiate the steps they need to take to avoid eviction? I mean, do you feel this is adequate protection for people facing eviction?
That's difficult because I think it also depends on like your personal position in life. I am really dialed in, so I know about that, but other people are not dialed in. There are barriers like, you know, we have like 90 different languages, I think, that are spoken in the Beaverton School District. I don't know if that information is getting to parents whose first language isn't English. And it also depends on your landlord, our management company, has actually sent out emails and posted stuff on our door, but that's up to them as individuals. So I'm not sure that this is going to be helpful for everyone. There probably should be a little more one-on-one outreach. And I'm not sure, again, it's up to the landlords. Maybe there will be opportunities where people can work it out. But if you're leaving it up to private citizens, there's definitely space where people are going to be failed by our current system.
Right. And, you know, one of the reasons why I'm asking, you know, these questions about housing is because housing is such, in fact, it seems to be the largest issue right now. Like, probably the pandemic is number one, and housing and all the related issues to housing are number two. Staying with housing for a minute, rising interest rates have slowed the rise of home prices, but still housing in Portland is scarce and unaffordable, and rent is tracking side by side of home prices. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's unaffordable too. What do you think of some of the ripple effects of a housing market that can't provide much housing? And, you know, if you get elected to the district, you know, what will you do to try to alleviate it?
Definitely, I think we're seeing the ripple effect of years of inequality with all of the people who are unfortunately having to live in tents outside. This problem hasn't been, it's not new. It's been growing for a while. And so the number one reason that we have homeless people is because housing is unaffordable. One-to-one for me, like, pretty evident. When I get into office, what I want to see happen is stronger renter protections, maybe mirroring what happens in Portland with relocation assistance, but also there is a prohibition on local jurisdictions having their own rent control rates. The state currently has, like, a 7% limit on rent increases annually, and then they also can raise it for inflation. So if inflation is 7% and rent goes up 7%, that's 14%. And I personally don't know anyone who got a 14% raise in the last year. So affording that rent hike is going to be really difficult. If you let local jurisdictions set their own rental rates or rent rate increases, they are in a more, direct position to act quickly and to know what their constituents need. If you're waiting for the state to implement something, it takes a lot longer, and you get this problem where people in Medford don't want people in Portland telling them what their rent rate should be based on housing prices that are not the same in Medford, maybe.
Right. During the pandemic, several private healthcare systems in Oregon faced strikes by healthcare workers who were afraid for their own health. Your Twitter account says you're going to be part of a protest by the Oregon Nurses Association of Provident Healthcare. But even providing for providers isn't enough for some opponents who against Medicare for All style plans that like the ones you promote. So why do you think there is so much resistance to Medicare for All style plans? And can you briefly explain what you see as the benefits of a Medicare for All plan?
Yeah, the biggest thing I think people have a problem with is change and the uncertainty of what that change might look like. And I don't think it's just for this issue that that's why you see so much resistance. I think in general, that's human nature. But the benefits of a Medicare for All style health plan is that everyone is in and nobody is out. And that also means that providers are guaranteed payments. They don't have to fight with insurance companies. The patients don't have to fight with insurance companies to get coverage. It just is covered. And if you're going to free up all that administrative time for providers so that they aren't having to fight those insurance companies, I think that's a huge benefit that we don't talk about a lot. I personally have, I lost a therapist last year because she was sick of dealing with my health insurance company. And that is a problem, not just for me as a customer, but her as a provider, like that is her business. So having a system where everyone is guaranteed coverage, and everyone who provides gets paid is the number one benefit.
You posted on your Twitter account your sadness over the loss of 500 people in your community from COVID. And you also mentioned that your mother passed away from COVID last year, and I'm sorry for your loss of her. As the state ends its mandatory mask mandate, I want to ask you what your thoughts are about how, you know, we want to be done with the virus, even if the virus isn't exactly done with us.
Yeah, I appreciate that phrase and that question. Personally, I want to continue to wear my mask to protect, you know, immunocompromised people, including in my own family and strangers who I don't know. If the science says that lifting the mask mandate is okay, then I guess we'll go with that. But I personally am not going to until I see a lot lower numbers. And I think we should be ready, or at least entertaining the idea that the mandate is going to come back. Because as you say, COVID might not be done with us.
In January, the Tigard police conducted an internal investigation of the shooting by Officer Gabriel Maldonado of Jacob Ryan McDuff last January, January 2021. Reports were that he had mental health issues. The grand jury last July did not move forward, but Tigard police decided to conduct their own investigation. Now, I've talked with a lot of candidates who, if they're running for a state office, say they don't think they have a lot of influence on municipal police departments. But I want to ask you what your thoughts are on how much effect state legislators could have or can have on how police departments use deadly force or conduct their own internal investigations.
I think the state has the opportunity to set statewide use of force standards. We can't, on a municipal level, be getting involved in their investigations, but we definitely can mandate the situations that they're legally allowed to use force in. And there should also be a duty to report by other officers if they think that there's been malfeasance or an abuse of power.
I want to follow up on that. A lot has been said of mental health intervention programs like the CAHOOTS program in Eugene or Portland's Safe Rest Villages program. Can you tell me what kind of efforts like that are being developed or are in place in Tigard to help avoid the kind of tragedies like the one that befell Mr. McDuff's family?
Unfortunately, I'm not really familiar with Tigard. I am more in Beaverton, but I would be interested to hear if they are developing something. I've heard of CAHOOTS, and in the city of Beaverton, I can't remember if they were the chair at the time or vice chair, went down to Eugene with former city councilor Kate Arnold to see how they were dealing with or how they had developed CAHOOTS and if it could be done here in Beaverton. But I'm not sure that that has moved forward because of the unexpected pandemic. I mean, that's not even, it's not just unexpected, it's like catastrophic.
In 2020, the group Timber Unity went to Salem, and it was full of protesters who were trying to stop a carbon tax bill that they said would raise the cost of doing jobs that had kept families in rural Oregon sustained for decades. Now, you say on your website that a habitable planet is a human right, and you say a just green transition is what we need. But what do you say to lumber mill workers who, you know, have seen Oregon lose 80% of its mills while, you know, what gets logged gets sent overseas and federal forests, in their view, sit neglected?
Part of the just green transition, and you can't see me doing the air quotes, just like as in justice, is to make sure that people who feel like they're going to be left behind by things like a carbon tax are definitely not left behind. Just because you can't work in timber anymore, which I don't think is entirely going to be the case, doesn't mean that you won't have a livelihood. You should be able to get the vocational training or any kind of education that you want to go into another field. I also think that Timber Unity is kind of an astroturf campaign. They want to come off as grassroots. They're spreading disinformation and they're using this fear that people have of their future and livelihood to get them to react to this legislation that doesn't do what they're being told that it does. And to counter that, I would hope that we can at least have conversations with people so that, you know, you have a human to human contact that really goes a long way in building trust and relationships.
I think this question is related to that one. You say that education is the foundation of a well-functioning society, and having a highly skilled workforce provides immeasurable economic benefits. But some people who are running for office in some of Oregon's rural counties have told me that retraining out of traditional natural resource-based jobs is next to impossible for some of those families. Is it impossible? And if it is, why is it? Why does there seem to be so much intransigence, even without the influences of groups like Timber Unity, for people to change careers?
I guess I would be curious to hear from them why they feel like it's impossible. It kind of reminds me of earlier when I said that people fear change and that's why they're so resistant to things. Maybe that's what's going on. But I don't think that it's impossible, and especially because I believe that we should have tuition-free education. And if they think that it's impossible because of funds, like if the state is going to make a change to have a more habitable planet, if you think you're going to reduce the harm of climate change, but you inflict harm on other people by them losing their jobs and you just leave them out to dry, that's not progress. It's a wash. So I don't believe it's impossible, but I would want to hear more from people who do think it's impossible so we can address that disconnect.
I have one more question related to education, specifically about the public employee retirement system. So a couple of years ago, the legislature implemented a temporary fix to PERS, which in part slowed its borrowing from the schools to fund the retirement of PERS recipients, but the debt's still growing. The Oregonian said a couple of years ago that the system had a $27 billion deficit. So how do you see PERS funding affecting the ability of Oregon schools, already one of the lowest rated school systems in the nation, to produce students ready for the workforce? I mean, education is one of your big platforms. Education is a human right.
I think we have this bad habit of pitting things against each other that shouldn't. A secure retirement that was promised to our public employees should not be pitted against the education and future of kids in Oregon. I personally think that we should have more revenue than we do. And I mentioned on my website also the Corporate Transparency and Accountability Act, which was a ballot initiative petition that was very popular when signature gatherers were out soliciting signatures. Because all it did would require disclosure from corporations on how much sales they're doing in the state of Oregon. And our discussions on tax increases, they get held up by these corporations saying, well, we can't afford those taxes and we'll have to leave. But if you're going to hold our budget hostage, you should at least have to tell us how much money you're making. And I think that if we were to have this disclosure requirement, we might see a bump in revenue just from that, because maybe corporations haven't always been honest with us. But that also gives us the beginning of the conversation of what it would look like to raise taxes on wealthy corporations, which I think would help us with PERS and education and job training programs and everything that we need to thrive.
So that looks at wages from one side, from the corporate side. But I wanted to ask about wages and how the view looks from the employee side. Companies from Amazon to Burgerville have done everything they can over the last few years to prevent employees from unionizing. But in those industries, there has been some progress, less so, as you say on your website, with ensuring domestic or agricultural or construction or gig workers, making sure they're properly paid or have decent benefits. Since you've been in office, you're aspiring to be in office, what do you plan to do to help improve a lot of those workers in jobs and in specialties that, you know, don't always have the protection of other union groups?
Well, I want to do whatever I can to make it easier for people to form unions. Even if you're not being horribly abused by your employer, you still deserve to unionize if that's what you want to do. And I don't think that we should be allowing things like captive meetings from the employers. And I also would want to use my platform as an elected official to bring light to these worker struggles. Like you said, on my Twitter, I posted about this nurses strike rally that's happening tomorrow, but I'm only a candidate right now. You know, as a legislator, I would have a much wider audience that I would be able to broadcast these struggles to, and I would be able to talk to the bully commissioner with a little bit more authority. I've also heard in some of my endorsement interviews with unions that there's sort of a lack of enforcement or teeth behind these laws, and I would want to explore how we would make them stronger.
And this is my last question. Why should the voters of District 35 elect you?
Well, I've been super active locally for at least the last 8 years. I'm very familiar with my district, and I think that my experiences as a dual national young woman of color reflect that of a lot of people who live in this district. I also am sort of a civics nerd. I've been paying attention to what's going on in the city of Beaverton just myself without this sort of plan to go to the legislature. So I've been collecting knowledge and making connections with people who are in office now so that we can work together to make laws that, like I said, will protect vital human rights for every Oregonian. It's the local elected, the city government really, that implement a lot of these changes and have a very direct impact on people's lives. And as a state legislator, I want to make sure that we have the laws in place that help them do an even better job.
All right. Well, Ms. Chachi, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Farah Chachi is a Democrat running for Oregon House District 35. I'm Don Merrill. Thanks for listening.